Well, I'm delighted to be joined by Dwight Steen Bonnicki, the director of the Searching for Skylab film, and also Joe Kerwin, who are both joining us from other side of the world, since this is a pre-record. Joe's up in Chicago and Dwight is in Germany. Dwight, we'll go straight to you first. Thanks for joining us today. It's the middle of the night over there. Tell us about this film that you've produced and directed.
Hi, Peter. Look, thanks for having me for this short interview. How did Searching for Skylab come about? I was writing a book called Life TV from the Moon, and a gentleman called Stan LaBar, who was the head of the Westinghouse Lunar Television Department, always referred to Skylab when he was telling me about the best television that he thought happened with NASA. And at the time, growing up in Australia, Peter, like we had the idea that, well, it crashed. How could it have been a great thing? Well, huh? And the more I talked to Stan, the more he was like, you have no idea what they were doing up there, television-wise, and the experiments. It was all fantastic. I went, okay, if you say so. And I ended up getting two books, one by David Hitt, which I have it on good authority that Joe Kerwin also co-wrote. And another one by David Shaler called Skylab. Homesteading Space is what David Hitt
Horrible.
and Joe Kerwin and Owen Garriott brought out. And I read through them and I went, oh, he's not wrong. And I was lucky at the time to get a hold of a lot of video that was sent down from Skylab. And it all had the slates on the front. And I put it in sequential order. And I started watching, I'm thinking, actually, yeah, as a person in television, what they were doing up there, television-wise, was fantastic. And so I have to spread the word about this. And one thing led to another. And somebody on Emily Carney's group, Space Hipsters, suggested to me that I do a film because every anniversary I would post a little snippet of what I had. And they said, you've got so much stuff. Why don't you make a movie out of it? And here, me working in television, but I've never been a director as such for a film, thought, well, without having any clue what's involved, thought, yeah, I'll do that. And so began my journey in making a film about Skylab, and that's how it came about.
Fantastic. And I think part of your description is it's kind of the forgotten space project, and part of what your mission to do with this film is to bring it back to people's attention. So I think you've
Well,
done a great job there.
like Peter, you know as well, when it crashed into Australia, that's all we heard about growing up. Skylab is coming down, Skylab is coming down, and it hit Western Australia. And it's unfairly been relegated into this sort of forgotten little pigeonhole from NASA, and that doesn't do it any justice at all. And I thought the guys who are up there need to be celebrated. They need to be honored. And I couldn't think of a better thing, as far as I was concerned, to make a film about it while the footage was available and not deteriorating. And these films you see behind me, they are the kinescopes and the 16 millimeter films that we use to make film. And I am so fortunate that I got my hands on them by writing the books about Skylab or editing the mission reports. I knew what I had to look for, so it came as second nature. So the film hopefully is as accurate as it could be.
Fantastic. So speaking of people that are up there, Joe Kerwin, thank you so much. It's evening time for you, so that's a bit more civilized. You joined us back in April of 2020 for the 50th anniversary of Apollo 13, which was just wonderful. Thank you for joining us for today. You've seen the film. You were involved in the film, of course. You were interviewed as part of it, but you've seen the film, the final production. What are your thoughts in this?
Well, as I was saying earlier, I'm having been there and pretty interested in Skylab and a lot of memories. I start watching the film and pretty soon I'm my own memory is superimposed on it and I'm enjoying myself tremendously. So I have no critique of the film whatsoever. To me, it's a journey back in time to when we set out to do something. It wasn't very exciting after you'd watched Apollo 11 and maybe Apollo 13, but it was pretty exciting to us. And there was a lot of satisfaction in going up there and coming back, all three of the crews, and able to say, close the book on Skylab, our goal, NASA's goal with Skylab, was to enable us to build and occupy space stations. We needed, you know, the engineering information. We needed the life support experience. We needed the medical and the proof to the world and the people in Congress that human beings can go up there and do a job and do it over a fairly long period of time. And thanks to Ed and the rest of that crew, we did it. So the fact that it doesn't get a lot of publicity is not a big deal. I hope to somehow stimulate a party in either Houston or Huntsville on the 50th anniversary, if I'm still around, and then forget about it. Meanwhile, here's the movie, and it captures the spirit beautifully. The feeling of disaster on day one, when the solar panel came off and the temperature zoomed and nobody knew what to do. And we went back to Houston and were we gonna launch ever? And then the following 10 days, which I think the movie captured quite well, and which were an enormous, beautiful, concentrated effort on the part of several centers and a lot of contractors and people in stores and places everywhere who had equipment that they didn't know might be needed. And somehow we found them, you know, and in 10 days went from a disaster to a spacecraft chock full of equipment, some of which we had never seen, stuck under the couch. And off we went, and that stuff worked. So, and to the extent that the movie can capture the excitement of meeting that challenge, and then the more the lower key, but still interesting, at least to us, meeting the challenge of living, working, and not screwing up in 28, 59, and 84 days. It was good. And it's a good show, and it's worth looking at.
Yeah. So, when were you assigned to the Skylab 2 mission? Although I note the patch, your Skylab patch, is actually called Skylab 1, although it's actually Skylab 2, being the second yes. flight on the Skylab project, the first.
Well, headquarters was Roman numeral 1, but center in charge was Marshall, and when they saw it, they said, no, that's not right. It's the first launch is 1, the second launch is 2, and they explained it in English to headquarters, and we said, oh, okay. But it was too late to change the head. So I wasn't assigned until obviously after Pete's flight, so it had to be run in 1971 that the formal assignment came. But some of us had been working Skylab since 1966. Since after they got the idea for the spent using the spent stage as a workshop, I remember Al Shepard or somebody called me up and said, like you and Kurt Michael to take a T-38 and go on out to California and take a look at the inside of the fuel tank of a third stage S-4B. And we went out there and this S-4B sitting there in the sunlight with the side hatch off. And we looked at the end hatch at the number of bolts and said, how are we going to get all those bolts open? And they said, we don't know, we'll figure it out. We looked in and we weren't allowed to go in because we might damage the insulation, but it had a very chemical smell in there. And it was the stuff they used to secure the lining on the inside. It was empty except for a couple of probes that were fuel probes to allow them to determine what the fuel level was when they were burning it, and a couple of small tanks of pressurized nitrogen to run things. That was it. And we said, well, what are we going to do when we get in there? And they said, we don't know. Sort of, that's your problem. But it was at a very, very early planning stage, okay? So we went back and reported to Al that it was interesting and needed a little work. And so, we started going to Huntsville in between our other projects fairly frequently. Al Bean went down there a little bit, but most of the time it was Paul Weitz and me taking a T-38. You could take off from Ellington Air Force Base, point the thing just a few degrees north of east, stay VFR so you could really, you know, go at Mach 0.95 and land in less than an hour, 58 minutes if you were good, at Redstone Arsenal Airfield in Huntsville. Grab a rental car, which they had waiting for you, and trundle over to the building and work on the floor plan, work on the procedures, try to get a window put in. We spent a lot of very wonderful hours in the underwater simulator at Huntsville and trained up so well that we were very comfortable in our suits with whatever they asked us to do. And that just kept on going and got more and more until finally, certainly right after Apollo 13, I dropped everything else and we trained for Skylab.
Right, so you were selected in 65, I believe, yeah, as an astronaut. And was that the first intake of scientist astronauts versus test pilot
astronauts? That's correct.
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah, we showed up in June of 65, and this is your office, and there's a Monday morning pilot meeting that they have every Monday, so it's over here. And the first pilot meeting, we sat in the back, and one of the astronauts said, Al Shepard was conducting the meeting, and he said, and headquarters has agreed that we can have another astronaut selection next year. And Dick Gordon said, are they going to be pilots? And Al said, well, I certainly hope so. And if I had him, I would have hoped so too. But that was fun. Yeah. So we came on board in 65, and this Skylab program started developing in 66.
Oh, okay. So
I was with it all the way, you know, for like 7 years until it flew. There's nothing as good as helping develop the spacecraft you're going to fly in. It was great.
You bet. So you're a qualified medical doctor, your background. So were you involved in designing and planning the equipment and also the experiments that were going to take place on the station?
My role was that of any moderately junior astronaut. You were the guy who was going to fly it. So you were responsible for having a pilot's eye or an operator's eye or an experimenter's eye and go through the procedures and say, this one is difficult. Can you change that? And we did that constantly throughout the process with all of the experiments and all of the work that we had to do to make sure that from a pilot's point of view, it was optimized if possible and at least doable. We had some great arguments with the experimenters, although we knew at the time that if this package of medical experiments could be done, it would be a beautiful outcome. It was an excellent set of experiments that ran the gamut of human physiology and did all the right things that you could do with three crews of three in a couple of months. It was good, but there were a lot of operational problems. We hashed them out with the investigators a little bit at a time. A typical story, the most unpopular medical experiment was the rotating chair, the vestibular experiment, the one where you had to move your head while rotating in all, you know, all three axes until you got nauseated. after trying it out a couple of times, and I don't remember if anybody actually barfed, but I think probably we did. We took a flight down to Pensacola where the principal investigator, Dr. Ashton Graybeal of Harvard University, was a really wonderful guy. He was very smart and very friendly. And the first thing he did when we came down there was he parked his red roadster by the airport so we could drive around the center. And so we met with him and it just explained what our problem was. And he said, well, basically, I have you going until you reach malaise 3, but we'll back off to malaise 2. And then we agreed that the commander on our flight would not do it at all because we didn't want a guy barfing while, you know, some emergency came up and he had to fly us home.
So is malaise a technical term for barfing, is it? Or is it a level of discomfort?
Yes, well, sort of. And by the way, we all have had shirts. I don't know what, I'm the only guy probably that still has one that had DSMS across the front. And that stands for Dreaded Space Motion Sickness, which was our name for what the agency chose to call Space Adaptation Syndrome. Okay. Said, no, it's not. It's motion sickness. But so, you know, over the years, we just went with each of them and tried to improve the experiments. Finally, about March of 73, Chris Kraft, who was the center director by that time, called the three of us, Conrad, Kerwin, and Weitz, up to his office and said, okay, are you guys done complaining and ready to go flying? And we said, absolutely. We think this is a go, and we're all for it. We're going to do the very best we can. And he said, well, all right.
Fantastic. So tell me about the launch and the initial approach to the station. Obviously your first time to fly in space. Was it a big surprise? Was it very similar to what you'd expected?
So well briefed, and to my left, in the left-hand couch, is Pete Conrad, who had flown several times by that time. He had landed on the moon. He and Al Bean were the only two experienced astronauts who stayed around for the Skylab program. The rest of us were rookies, and we're very glad we had those two to get us ready and to fly with us. So it was a pretty relaxed cockpit, even with the uncertainties that lay ahead. What were we going to find, and could we fix it? But Pete's approach to that was that he maybe 10 minutes before liftoff, we had a couple minutes to spare. He said, "Guys, I'm trying to think of something to say as we clear the tower, because the guys on the ground need a little morale boost, I think." And we talked about it a little bit, and then came launch. And Pete says, "Houston, this is a Skylab 2, tower clear. We fix anything."
Fantastic.
Just the positive approach, you know, sassy old Pete, competent. He was great to work for. Once he figured out you were doing the right things, he just let you do them.
That's great. And of course, he had the famous comment when he stepped on the moon, didn't he? We were talking about before.
Yep. It was this may have been a small step for Neil, but it's a giant leap for me.
Because he was a pretty short guy too, wasn't he, Pete?
Yeah.
He was quite short, Pete Conrad, I believe.
He was, yes. Yeah. And he landed quietly, and his struts didn't compress. So he was a little farther from the ground, maybe a foot or two from the ground than Neil was.
Right. So, of course, I think in the film you state you watched the launch of the Skylab Saturn V, the actual station, from the roof of the operations building. Yes. And it kind of disappeared in the cloud fairly quickly. Is that right?
That was a pretty, as I recall, it wasn't a very cloudy day at all.
Oh, okay.
It went soaring off in a beautiful shape, but by the time they went supersonic, we couldn't see it anymore.
Oh, I see. And that's when the damage took place.
That's right.
Right.
So we saw nothing. It looked like a perfect launch. And not till we went back and put our headsets on and listened to the air to ground that we figured out we had a problem.
Right. So how much did you actually know about what the station condition and what it looked like? I read somewhere that I think the Department of Defense used one of their secret ground-based devices to have a look at the station. Did you get a look at that imagery or whatever?
We got a look at that imaging. It was done. And I really don't know today whether it was a ground-based telescopic camera thing or whether it was in orbit. It might have been in geosynchronous. But so they had a fuzzy picture that showed one solar wing gone and the other one looked like it was stuck. And that's about what we knew until we got up close.
I've just
the important stuff.
I've just found it. It's a National Reconnaissance Office user, KH8 Gambit 3. I don't know. Dwight, do you have any idea what that is?
Yeah, I do. It's a very technical description and it'll take too long to explain.
All right, fantastic. Yeah, righto. So, of course...
I've got a question for Joe. Yeah. Your association with Australia is not just via this Zoom call. You've actually been to Australia, haven't you?
I was assigned to Australia as the senior science representative from NASA, if you please. And it was, of course, after Skylab's demise. And I was delighted to... I got offered the job and I went back home and I, around the dinner table, said, you know, I've been offered a job in Australia. It'd be a couple of years and take the family. I don't suppose y'all would be interested. And they all said, yeah, that sounds pretty good. So off we went. And I got off the plane by myself. The kids were not with me. They came a little later. And went over to the office, was introduced to my secretary, and the phone rang. And she liked that. And I picked it up and said, the NASA representative. And this guy from Western Australia was describing what turned out to be a burned oxygen tank from Skylab, which he had, and wondered if NASA was still buying them. I thought that was a heck of a great first call for being an Australian for the next couple of years. They were very friendly. I had a wonderful time. We didn't buy the tank, but we confirmed that it was a Skylab tank, and he said he'd put it up over the door to his bar in somewhere in Western Australia.
I believe there is a museum. Have you been over to that museum at Esperance?
I don't know. I never made it out to the museum.
Right. Oh, you've been there, Dwight.
We were there January of last year, and I was there for the 40th anniversary of the impact. Yeah. And I went to the museum, and it's amazing the workmanship of Skylab. You can pick up a electronic component, and you can still see that the wires are soldered to the contact points within the piece of equipment. Like, the casing has broken open, but the stuff inside is still intact. And for example, the fridge that you had in the wardroom, that you can still, if you plugged it in, I guarantee that thing would work. Amazing workmanship. That stuff is pristine, considering it came tumbling down at, I don't know, whatever speed it hit the earth. In the film, you get to hear one of the people in the fields who was on his field in the middle of the night, who saw it come flying over his head.
Planned reentry, the semi-planned reentry of Skylab is a great story to me, how Charlie Harlan and his boys were able to recapture communications with this spacecraft, which had been tumbling in space for X number of years, and managed to control its attitude, got an IBM guy out to reprogram the computer to give them an optimum attitude for low drag. And then to figure it all out, when to maneuver the Skylab from low drag to maximum drag to slow it down and impact it in water safely rather than New York or Moscow or someplace else, you know.
Melbourne.
And it worked pretty well. Yeah, most of it went in west of Australia. Some of the heavier parts made it onto the continent, but they did a great job. And the neat part of the story is that when Charlie's guys had their forecast all made, they had to get permission. And so they called Chris Kraft at Houston, and he set them up with the guys at NASA headquarters. And one of the managers at headquarters objected strenuously. He said, if we make an estimate and an attempt and it still lands in the city, will be dead as an agency. But if we just say we couldn't help it, it'll be better. Well, they talked him out of that. Okay. Hung up the phone from headquarters, and Kraft said to Charlie Harlan, now unplug your phone and pull it out of the wall. We don't want those guys to change their minds.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
I can tell you this much about Esperance and the whole area where this where Skylab crashed. There is no more beautiful site in the world where it could have happened. I was standing up on the Wireless Hill, it's called, and you have a total 360-degree view of the ocean of Esperance, north and south. And I just thought to myself, wow, standing here in 1979 and watch this thing come over as a final resting place, I can't imagine of any more beautiful place in the world. It fits. And that's why actually as well, I put in the Indigenous Australian story at the end about the constellation Orion, because the pulse code, this is the thing that got me, the beacon pulse that they used to track Skylab had a sound that I was listening to in Sydney when I first heard this audio. And I'm like, hey, that sounds like a kookaburra. And then I was doing a bit of research in Aboriginal astronomy and came across this story about the three brothers that were banished up to the heavens in their canoe. And I thought, wow, that's really prophetic, considering that's a 20,000-year-old story about three men who are up in space in a canoe. And I thought, wow. There is some sort of an association with Australia. We've got three honorary Australians in the group right now talking. Joe, I think your honorary Australian membership is valid lifetime.
Indeed.
So, yeah, just the... I must say, again, you know, I was talking at the beginning that Skylab, when I was a young boy, for me, that was... I don't like to use the word a not very successful mission, but that is what got me interested in it. There was a poster that another student had put up in the principal's office that said Skylab is falling, and I read all the stuff he wrote. It was always in the back of my mind, and look at that, 40 years later, I am the one that tells this story in a film format. And that is, if you had told the young 10-year-old me back then that that's what I would do, I would like, hey. it's been a pleasure. It's been an honor to tell you your story to the world, you know. Couldn't think of anything.
It makes me happy and proud and proud to be associated with you, who did such a great job.
Yeah. Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So, Joe, you continued to be involved with NASA. Obviously, you were out in Australia as the liaison officer. And I was reading you actually considered at one stage for a space shuttle mission, but because you were out in Australia, you were not able to take that opportunity up. Was that something of interest to you?
I wanted to fly in a shuttle, and I don't remember the exact year but I think it was 1980. George Abbey, who ran crew operations at that time, offered me the first Skylab medical flight. Well, I knew that was going to be at least another 5 or 6 years away, and I would be rapidly scurrying across the ocean back and forth. And my kids were at an age where their parents ought to be around. And I said, George, can't you fly me on, you know, shuttle 2 or 3 or 4 or 5? I'll even go without an ejection seat. I don't want to commit to that other mission long term.
Right.
So he said, okay, and that's the only offer I ever got.
Oh, that's an honorable thing to do. Putting the family first is always the most important thing, isn't it?
Don't regret it a bit. Family all had a great time in Australia, and we saw them grow up, and they are all clustered around helping their mom right now anytime they're needed.
That's wonderful.
Talked to two of them on FaceTime today.
Oh, is that lovely? Oh, terrific. Cool. It's fantastic the technology has been able to allow us to do this sort of thing in this global pandemic and all the other things that have gone on. So that's wonderful. Yeah. So your time in Australia, you also met up with a lot of the guys from the Deep Space Tracking Network, Mike Dinn and John Saxon and those people who were involved in Apollo.
We visited all the stations and loved it.
And also they, of course, involved heavily in Skylab. And in fact, I think a lot of the guys in that network, and also I think Pete Conrad said that Skylab was a highlight of their career. Even though Pete Conrad walked on the moon, he said that Skylab was the highlight. Is that true?
From my perspective, it certainly
is. Of course, yes. Yeah.
Don't know about theirs, but it was just, you know, it was a great mission for them to be part of. Even though most of the world doesn't know what their part was, it was important. It was crucial. Mm. And we got along beautifully, and I still have good thoughts about all of them.
All right, we're going to finish up shortly, but we just learned this week that the passing of Glenn Lunny. Did you know and work with Glenn at Johnson?
I knew Glenn moderately well from post-Apollo years, and he was one of the two or three best flight controllers and flight directors that NASA ever had. Put him right up there with Chris Kraft and Gene Kranz. Most intelligent and a beautiful manager. He had an attitude. I don't know how you ever get that way, but he could just listen to people, and he never lost his cool, and he never lost his temper, and he got the orchestra to play together. And of course, on Apollo 13, that was particularly outstanding.
Indeed.
Good guy.
Fantastic. So do you keep in touch with any or many of your Skylab alumni?
There's only two of them left, aren't there?
Yeah, well, that's right. Yes. Yeah.
The crews. So it'll be fun to talk to them in a little while if it gets so arranged.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. Yeah. So that'll be 2023 for the 50th. Is that right? Have I got my numbers right?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Oh, well, it's not far away. We're well into 2021 now. So, yeah, look forward to...
Down to 2 years now.
Yeah, look forward to being involved in that. And hopefully we'll be able to travel again so we could actually meet up in person. That would be just terrific. That would be
nice. Yeah. We'll see what happens.
Yeah.
Thanks for having me.
It's been our pleasure. Thank you, Dwight. Any last-minute comments from you, Dwight?
No, it's a fascinating story. So you're all in for a treat. The Apollo 11 movie as well is outstanding. To see it on a big screen, I haven't seen it myself on a big screen. I've got it on the 55-inch TV here. So I can only imagine what it looks like when you're seeing all that 70-millimeter stuff in grand detail. And of course, there's that really cool movie about Skylab that looked really good in a big screen format as well. So you're in for a treat tonight, a double feature. And thank you for showing up. Thank you so much, Joe, for taking the time out to talk to us today. And you've, without knowing, contributed to me breaking my record riding home on the push bike from work, 10 kilometers. I think I did it in 28 minutes. I've never done it that quick before.
Wow.
So, without going through red lights as well. I was very, as they say here in Germany, artig, you know, very obeying the rules.
That's
good. So, yeah. All right. So I wish everybody a great viewing experience tonight.
All right. Thank you, Dwight. Really appreciate that. Joe, once again, thank you so much. Take care. Look after yourself. And of course, best wishes to your wife as well. And we'll keep in touch in 2023, if not before. Thanks, everyone. Take care.
So long. Bye
now.
Cool. Bye.
So I'll just stop the recording.